Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
It's Tuesday, the 26th of December, 2017. Welcome to this edition of Africa Link, coming to you live from our studios here in Bonn, Germany. I am Zipporah Nyambura.
And I'm Jane Ayeka Kumet. Africa Link is also live on Facebook, that is DW Africa. So do join the conversation.
Coming up, low turnout as Liberians go to the polls. But what is the mood in the country?
Majority of our people in this country, they are frustrated because lack of good education system, roles, opportunity for job.
And we shall also hear about the growing frustration among Liberian youth and Russian President Vladimir Putin's nomination to vie for presidency for a fourth time.
But first, let's listen to what has been happening around the world.
I'm Sertan Sanderson with DW News. Liberians are voting to pick a successor to President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf today. The runoff vote, originally scheduled for November 7, was delayed for several weeks after Vice President Joseph Boakai filed a complaint of fraud and incompetence against the Electoral Commission, following his first-round loss to former international footballer George Weah. The Supreme Court rejected that complaint. Boakai said that the election today was an opportunity to highlight Liberia's democracy, saying that he would accept whatever the outcome of the vote.
It's a great day because it's a test of democracy. We went in one time, there were 20 of us. Now we reduced to 2. We have delayed, we've gone through the coup process. This is what the process has produced. We're willing to live with it.
His challenger, George Weah, meanwhile, said that he was sure to win.
I'm not associated with losing. So this victory is certain, and I'm going to win. Or Boakai cannot win, or George Weah.
Boakai, the leader of the ruling Unity Party, had received only 28.8% of the October 10 vote, compared to 38.8% for Weah, who represents the Coalition for Democratic Change. The runoff election was called, however, with neither candidate making it past the 50% mark to win outright in the initial vote. Authorities in Egypt have executed 15 people held responsible for attacking security forces in the Sinai region. The militants were hanged in 2 northern prisons where they had been held since being sentenced for the attacks. Last week, Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi vowed once more that his military would use its full range of options against jihadist militants who have been waging an insurgency since the army overthrew Islamist President Mohamed Morsi in 2013. You're listening to DW News. Peru's President Pedro Paolo Kuczynski made a public address to explain his pardon of former President Alberto Fujimori following a second day of protests in the capital, Lima. Kuczynski stated humanitarian reasons, taking Fujimori's ailing health into account. Critics note, however, that the pardon came just 3 days after Fujimori loyalists in Congress saved Kuczynski from a vote that would nearly have toppled him. 79-year-old Fujimori was serving a 25-year sentence for human rights violations, including the ordering of death squads against his political opponents. The former leader, meanwhile, also made a public statement thanking President Kuczynski for the pardon while asking Peruvians for forgiveness. A court in northeast China has handed down an 8-year sentence for subversion to the well-known activist Wu Gan. The activist, who is better known by his self-proclaimed moniker, Ultra Vulgar Butcher, was found guilty of undermining state power for posting attention-grabbing activism campaigns online. He had been held in pre-trial detention for 2 years. Wu was one of the first activists caught up in a major government clampdown on rights campaigners in 2015. Wu's sentence is the most severe yet against rights activists and lawyers. And for more news and information, please go to dw.com. I'm Sertan Sanderson.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link, a program that keeps you up to date with all that's happening around the continent and beyond. I'm Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I am Zipporah Nyambura. And today we start off in Liberia. They have gone to the polls in a delayed presidential runoff to elect a new president to replace the country's current first woman president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf. The process went smoothly, although there was a low voter turnout in many of the polling stations. The runoff pits former football star George Weah against Vice President Joseph Boakai, with both men promising a break with a heritage of poverty and corruption. The poll, originally scheduled for early last month, was delayed due to legal battles at the Supreme Court following complaints filed by Boakai alleging fraud in the first round of the voting. Evelyn Pade filed this report from Monrovia, now presented by Isaac Mugabi.
Former international footballer George Weah and Vice President Joseph Boakai joined voters in casting their ballots in Liberia as they went head-to-head in a delayed runoff vote for the presidency. After casting his ballot, George Weah was full of confidence that this time round he would win the election, unlike in the past when he lost to outgoing President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf.
I'm not associated with losing. Today's this victory is certain, and I'm going to win. Obuaka cannot win or George Weah. Ellen Johnson won because she's an exceptional case. And what happened cannot happen again.
Weah is squaring up against Vice President Joseph Boakai, who is also hoping to win the election in the second and final round after the first round was marred by allegations of fraud.
It's a great day because it's a test of democracy. We went in one time, there were 20 of us. Now we reduced to 2. We have delayed, we've gone through the coup process. This is what the process has produced, and we're willing to live with it.
Despite both candidates cheering up their supporters at the different polling stations, the turnout was low. There are at least 2.2 million voters, and a fifth of whom are young people aged 18 to 22 years.
The turnout is poor because yesterday was a festival. People went out for party. The issue why people are voting is that they want to see a change.
I find it easier because the line is short today. The other day were large, were a whole lot of people here.
Majority of our people in this country, they are frustrated because lack of good education system, roles, opportunity for job, and some are already coming out to vote. My appeal to them, because if we think on the right, we might just vote wrongly.
This is the first peaceful and democratic election sponsored and conducted by Liberians in over 70 years. The question on whether it will be George Weah or Joseph Boakai will be known in 4 days' time.
That report was filed by Evelyn Pade in Monrovia.
And we stay in Liberia and hear about the growing frustrations among young people. Whoever will be the country's next president, Liberians want just one thing: a leader who will revive the ailing economy and create jobs. As unemployment continues to rise, young people are feeling more and more hopeless. Our correspondent Jan Philip Scholz spoke with some of them, and they told him all the leaders had done was to make empty promises.
Alvin Talu imagined his post-university future would be quite different. Now, he's lucky he'll sell 2 mobile phones a day, earning the equivalent of about 3 euros. Despite graduating with a business administration degree 4 years ago and countless job applications, he is still unemployed. Alvin says the frustration among young people here is palpable and growing. He's worried that it could tip into violence.
Better I remain hungry with a future to come than to have any disturbance. I know what it takes to have uprising and to beat at this level. Because with uprising, you don't have no peace. Your life is highly at risk.
Liberia's civil wars began in 1989 and finally ended in 2003. But this West African nation's economy has hardly grown since then.
You don't have to come and promise people, give them fake promises to say, oh, I'll create 100,000s of jobs, when you know it's not available or it's not possible to do.
Things that they do need to be real and tangible so that we have confidence in them. Solomon Pay is trying to give his students an education and some hope. But as a business teacher, he knows very well that the same promises of jobs were made during the election 6 years ago. In his opinion, Liberia's politicians have failed to undertake the necessary economic reforms.
Every year, the
the university in Liberia increase their number of graduates. But yet, some of the guys just sitting home. So one of the main things that I feel that government should do, look at the educational sector, and the next thing, bring in investors. When the investors come, the economy will open.
For Elvin Talu, he hopes the tense election atmosphere will soon be over, and then business might pick up again.
Ian Philip Scholz with that report.
We are also live on Facebook. Thank you to those who are commenting on our page. We have someone from Nigeria by the name Usman Damaturu who is calling on the people of Liberia to vote wisely for the candidate that will deliver and overcome their national challenges.
And comments that came in just shortly before we came on air. Brown Materia says, I'm from DRC. Where is African legend? He helped the Liberian team in the moment the country was down, so he footed all the bills and he should be voted president.
Yeah, Joseph Eboa is saying, may the right candidate win.
And Yao Abad from Ghana says, this is the mistake we commit in Africa, equating stardom or popularity to leadership. Does Weah have any governance experience or leadership qualities? Governance is not a Champions League. Well, maybe to just inform Mr. Yao Abad that Weah has a little bit of, or has some, of course, has some experience in Liberian politics, having been in the Liberian Senate since 2015. So he does have experience there. I'm not campaigning for him, but just a clarification.
Yes, it's good to clarify, Jane. And with that, now I'll take you to Russia. And it's all about elections as well. President Vladimir Putin will once again be vying for the country's top post in March 2018 following his nomination in Moscow. Unlike previous polls, Putin, who has been in power for 18 years, will vie as an independent candidate, breaking away from his party, the United Russia Party. This comes a day after the country's Electoral Commission banned opposition leader Alexei Navalny from running against Putin, citing embezzlement conviction. Leila Harak talked to DW's Emily Shervin. And first we hear, what chances does Putin have in the March 2018 elections?
Polls show that Putin is likely to take 60% to 80% of the votes, whether you look at independent polls or government polls. And that's kind of the big job that the Kremlin has in front of it at the moment, to make these votes, these elections interesting in order to bring turnout up. On the weekend, the Kremlin said, according to media reports, that they wanted turnout to be as high as 70%. Now, to do that, they need to present Putin as a new candidate. And perhaps him running as an independent is a strategy to do that.
All right. Now let's talk a little bit about Navalny. He has been characteristically defiant, called for a boycott. Talk to us about his supporter base. How large is it? And is there any other credible contender who can challenge the incumbent president?
Well, it's hard to know in exact numbers how big his supporter base is. In the run-up to this decision, Navalny has been campaigning all over the country, and even in smaller cities like Omsk, hundreds of people have come out in support, in his support. So he does seem to have a rather large supporter base. In fact, around the country, over 15,000 people suggested his candidacy on the weekend. So he does have quite a supporter base. It is still presumably a minority when it comes to the entire country. And the other opposition figures, or in fact, all opposition figures in polls have shown to only poll in the low single digits. So the question is whether the opposition had a chance in the first place in these elections.
DW correspondent in Moscow, Emily Shervin, talking to Leila Harak.
Now, Zippy, let me take you to another story that we've been covering on our social media platforms. Now, there have been reports from the Democratic Republic of Congo that 9 soldiers were killed in an ambush by a suspected rebel militia group in South Kivu. Now, the military official accused the Mai Mai militia of being responsible for the attacks. And on that, our correspondents have also been writing. For instance, mm-hmm. Ada Kiwol says, President Kabila, round up the insurgency and leave innocent people to live without fear.
Joram Nomso says, peace is priceless and terror is senseless.
And Hakim Ibrahim says, very sad news. May their souls rest in eternal news. We'll be right back. You're still listening to DW's Africa Link program. I'm Jane Ayeko-Kemet.
And I am Zipporah Nyambura. Remember, Africa Link is live on Facebook at DW Africa. So do join the conversation and share the audio.
But first, coming up in the next 15 minutes, competition for resources as the number of homeless people here in Germany grows.
Are you kidding me? It's more than just envy, it's hatred. I'm sorry if I have to be the one who says it. It's real hatred.
And we shall also hear how African migrants have revived church in the Greek island of Lesbos. But first?
Yes, first to Nigeria, where the army said it had thwarted a planned attack by Boko Haram in Maiduguri, claiming the situation was now under control. On several occasions, the Nigerian army has claimed to have wiped out the militia group, but its remnants continue to launch attacks on villages around. DW's Muhammad Alamin is on the ground and has been telling me the latest.
Well, despite repeated claims by the Chief of Army Staffs, General Tukur Buratai, and the Nigerian federal government that Boko Haram has been defeated, the terrorist group's action recently is telling a different story. The group has come back with a full force and attacking villages and sub-targets in Maiduguri and other places. So definitely the situation is contrary to what the army and the Nigerian government are saying.
Like you just said, the group is coming back attacking villages. How much of a threat is the group still to the Nigerian government?
Definitely the group is posing a serious threat in northeastern part of Nigeria. You see, there are some places that one cannot even go to the area because it's totally controlled by Boko Haram. The soldiers were based in most of the local council headquarters, but if you go outside the council headquarters with, let's say, 2 or 3 to 5 kilometers, you meet Boko Haram fighters there. Definitely, they are not in control of the headquarters of local government, but most of the villages in Borno and Yobe State are controlled by Boko Haram.
Now, you say that there are certain areas that are a no-go area for other people. Is the army still pursuing Boko Haram in these areas, or are the army withdrawn and only protecting the people within the IDPs and the villages where people are settled?
Let me tell you that the road that links Maiduguri to Biu is not a friendly way that one cannot just drive. Even with the security escort, the Boko Haram always attack a convoy of the drivers that are going from Biu to Maiduguri. And the situation is the same thing. Just of recent Boko Haram attack convoy of United Nations trucks, they are taking aids to particular areas in Ngala. Boko Haram attacks and even kill some drivers. So Boko Haram is, they are still strong to my understanding.
With this kind of attacks, is there a likelihood that the militia could regroup and launch bigger attacks?
There is that possibility if care is not being taken, because even though the groups is splitted, but they are trying to regroup, maybe launch a serious attack in Maiduguri or other places in northeastern Nigeria.
Muhammad Alamin with the latest from Nigeria.
Africa on the move.
For many people, Christmas is traditionally a time of giving. Many refugees and migrants, whatever their faith, might be recipients of this kind of collection if they find themselves in a new land without a house or a strong community backing. But the next story is about to change that image of refugees and migrants as the beneficiaries of charity. That is because on the Greek island of Lesbos, it is the African migrants who have been giving something back to the community. They have revived the local Catholic church, which had fallen largely into disuse, and brought life back into the old building and community. Alexia Kalatsi recently took a trip to the island and joined them in the church.
It's Sunday morning on the island of Lesbos. The island's Catholic church is filled with people singing hymns and praying. Just 2 years ago, this building was almost unused. But since African migrants arrived on the island, life has been breathed back into the community. Edmund, a 26-year-old asylum seeker from Cameroon, says that going to church is a beacon of hope for many members of the African community of the island who are keen to escape the harsh realities of the camp at Moria.
Church, me going to church is really from my childhood, and most of the African people who also come to church, I think it is same for them. I think when they go and talk to God personally, make their own prayer, they feel more relief from the heavy load they are carrying on this island.
The heavy load Edmund refers to is the uncertainty facing most of the migrants here. They have lost faith in the asylum application procedure in Greece.
Nearly all refugees here in Lesbos knows that Greece is not a welcome country because they don't even believe in the asylum procedure here. They know that political opinion have taken over logic.
And as disciples of Christ, we are called to share this gift with others.
Before the migrants arrived, the church community was so small that the island lacked a Catholic priest. Now Leonard Mitchum, a resident here, has volunteered to become a subdeacon so that he can celebrate Holy Mass on Sundays.
I think the great thing is that we have a community here every Sunday. It provides them with some respite and some hope in the situation in Moria, which is quite desperate, really. And they've come here in the hope of a better life. And I think in some ways our services here maintain that hope.
Apart from offering them hope, the Catholic Church has become a meeting point between immigrants and members of the Greek community. A local NGO called Synyperxy meets the immigrants in churchyard after the end of Mass and offers them sandwiches while talking to them. Stratis Pothas is a volunteer for Synyperxy.
Όταν τελειώσει η λειτουργία, στο προάβλιο, πάντα θα τους προσφέρω με κάτι.
When the whole Mass ends in the churchyard, we always offer the migrants something. We may stay there half an hour. This is the time for communication. They will not only ask us questions about the issues they have, but also meet one another because they do not all live in the same camps. It's a bit like going to the cafeteria or meeting for lunch.
And from chatting over sandwiches, alliances have been formed and excursions organized to see the rest of the island. Through the church, the migrants are starting to feel more integrated. There might still be opposition to having a migrant camp on the island, but at least for those attending church, this Christmas is all about showing goodwill towards each other.
Alexios Kalatsi reporting from the Greek island of Lesbos.
Focus Europe.
Here in Germany, or rather in Bonn, the number of homeless people is on the rise. According to the Bundesarbeitsgemeinschaft Wohnungslosehilfe, an institution that provides accommodation to homeless people, some 860,000 people are homeless in Germany, and the number is expected to reach 1.3 million next year. Here in Bonn, Gabriel Brood went to downtown to find out more.
This is Jamal. He's 42 years old and on the street in Bonn and on the verge of giving up.
Oh, yeah, bestimmt 30 Wohnungen. Komm bestimmt hin.
By now, it's been at least 30 apartments I've looked at. Maybe if I use my connections, maybe then I'll get lucky. It's just really hard. We're living in a world where you can be thrown away even by the people you love. And now I'm living in this homeless shelter. And who knows, there are rules here too. I'm a drug addict, it's true, and I can relapse at any time. And when that happens, maybe they'll throw me out. And then I'd be completely on the street.
One of the social workers at the shelter where Jamal and dozens like him are living these days is Ricarda Miebach.
The situation is serious, yes. We're aware that some people need long-term help. They're dependent on this. Because of their addiction or psychological needs, they can't live alone. And then it's our responsibility to give this person a home so that they can live here for as long as that person needs.
Der Mensch bekommt eine Bleibe bis hin dazu, dass er wirklich für immer bleiben kann.
When the living space is scarce, like you say, are there
fights between the homeless and, let's say, new people who are coming to Germany, let's say refugees who are being given living space?
Ja, ich glaube, also Kämpfe oder Konflikte in dem Sinne gibt es erstmal nicht.
Fights? Conflict? No, I don't think there are fights between the homeless here and the refugees. But I do think there is a lack of understanding. The homeless here are concerned with their own situation, their own struggle to survive. There's no rage or trouble with the refugees. That's not what it's about.
If you ask Helmut outside about how the homeless view the situation with the refugees, he'll tell you a different story than we've just heard.
Und frag nicht nach Sonnenschein, ich wollte nur nicht so krass ausdrücken. Das ist schon kein Nein mehr, das ist schon Hass. Entschuldigung, das ist regelrechter Hass.
Are you kidding me? It's more than just envy, it's hatred. I'm sorry if I have to be the one who says it. It's real hatred. And it's going to escalate. It already has escalated, but nobody pays attention to us. We're just brushed under the rug. Of course, there's envy and hatred. When I think about these new people and what they get and how they can't behave, and then I see elderly women, 70 or 80 years old, who are collecting cans to get by, I must say, I get rage in my eyes. These women were the ones who rebuilt our country from the ashes, and they don't get a pension. I thought this country was rich. I thought we were the export world champions. Where are these billions? Where are they?
There are more and more people like this in Germany who are just watching their lives fly by. As daunting as the task seems, of trying to help people like Doza somehow hang on, Ricarda Miebach from the shelter says this is precisely her calling, because what's going on outside her office, she says, is not a parallel world.
Gabriel Burud with that report, giving us an insight of what it means to be homeless here in Germany, isn't it?
Yes, it does happen story. In Germany as well.
Well, the news, the stories today haven't been very pleasant. Homeless people, migration, attacks here and there. It seems like the world is not a happy world. And perhaps that explains our next comment that comes from Eddie Ballard. He comes from the Gambia. Remember, the Gambia is one country that has been sending lots of migrants. And he's studying in Japan. And he sent us a very, very interesting poem. And
oh, here a poem?
Yes, he sent us a poem. And we'll just read a little bit of it. It goes, "When will my tears dry? You said you were protecting civilians. Then you killed Gaddafi. Libya became a battlefield, a paradise for the smuggler.
Gateway to the Mediterranean Cemetery. Mothers are crying. Gators are lonely.
Our leaders are silent. The African Union remains mute. Today, I woke up to the news of another boat disaster.
Yesterday, I saw a mother crying like a child. I saw a neighborhood lose a dozen of their youth.
A whole village in mourning. I met a couple that just became childless. When will my tears dry?
Not when Europe becomes the only hope of our young, not when the youths believe that we cannot make it here."
And that's just part of his poem. Thank you so much, Eddie, for sending us. You can find a whole long version of that poem on our DW Facebook page. That's DW Africa. And people are still commenting. There are still some comments coming about the Liberian story, isn't it?
Yes, Jane, you're right on that. We have lots of people who are actually seem to be backing George. There's Najane Bema who says, "Vote for George Weah." And he's saying, "Please." And someone else is simply saying, "Good luck to Liberia."
Indeed, there's good luck to Liberia. Wishes coming from everywhere. But just one quick one, which says, "Politics has garbled our senses of reasoning and views. When I look at how politicians are exploiting youth in this country, it hurts my soul. It hurts me to the very soul. Youth need liberty to take this country and this continent forward."
Yeah, which is what the poem was actually talking about. The
yes.
Youth, you can make it wherever you are.
I think it's a good message to the African youth that you don't have to look to Europe, especially if you're going through the back door. That's what it's called in the Gambia. You can make it wherever you go. That's all we had time for. Thank you for your comments. We shall be here tomorrow same time. From me, Jen Ayeka Kumet.
And me, Zipora Nyambura. It's bye for now.
Have a wonderful time.